Good afternoon. My name is Susan Muirhead, and today I'll be reading part one of the News Gazette, dated for this date, Tuesday, March 13th, 2018. Let's begin with the reading of some of today's headlines. The first headline reads, Champaign County Nursing Home, proposal would put empty wing to use. An addiction treatment group seeks six-month lease. This article is written by Tom Kachik and is based out of Urbana. County board members will hold a special meeting today to consider a lease agreement with Rosecrance, that's Rosecrance Health Network, to use one wing of the Champaign County Nursing Home for addiction treatment for about two dozen patients. The meeting, beginning at 6 p.m. at the Brookins Administrative Center, will precede a regular county board committee of the whole meeting. No details of the agreement were included in the special meeting agenda, but a request for proposals issued last month in connection with the possible sale of the nursing home disclosed that the county has been approached by a nonprofit corporation about leasing an empty wing of the nursing home on a short-term basis, 6 months, with a clause allowing month-to-month extensions that would yield the county more than $16,000 a month. Rosecrance would also contract with their nursing home to provide meals, linen service, and limited cleaning service. County Board Chairman C. Pius, P-I-U-S, Weibel, W-E-I-B-E-L, said Monday that under the lease agreement, the county would be paid $16,860 a month for use of the space for inpatient addiction therapy for patients who would stay at the facility for up to 45 days. They're all screened ahead of time. They're all, so to speak, dried, he said. This is a volunteer basis. They're not being forced to go here. It's basically their decision to be here. Patients and staff in the Rosecrance wing would use a separate entrance on the east side of the nursing home, and Rosecrance patients would not intermingle with nursing home residents, he said. There already are fire doors, and we will have combination locks in both directions, he said. There will be Rosecrance employees there during normal working hours, and at nighttime, there will be a security person there. The nursing home and Rosecrance residents wouldn't mix at all, Weibel said. He said he thinks the proposed agreement would help the county and Rosecrance. Rosecrance has been providing therapy in the community for some time, and they needed a temporary place, and we can accommodate that, he said. And it does bring us some extra money for a while. County board members have been briefed on the agreement in recent weeks, and Weibel said he believes it will be approved. Separate meetings were also held with nursing home staff and family members of nursing home residents. We were concerned about family members at the nursing home who might have some negative feedback, but we had a meeting last week and we almost had a negative comment, but we didn't, said Weibel, who estimated 60 to 80 people attended. He was very supportive. They had questions. They were most concerned about intermingling. But the idea that they would be entirely separate and that the only connection would be closely monitored and that it would only be the exchange of food or linens across the doorway, I would say they had concerns, but they were very satisfied with the answers. The lease agreement would begin April 1st, and Rosecrance patients would start moving into the facility in mid-April, Weibel said. Use of the nursing home would be an interim solution for Rosecrance while it is assessing a permanent site in the community, he said. The county nursing home, which has 243 beds, had an average daily census of about 136 in January, according to a report by the home's manager. The next headline reads, Election 2018 Primary. Early voting now in high gear. 8 voting sites available today for casting ballots. This article is again written by Tom Kachik and is based out of Urbana. Early voting in Champaign County expands to 8 sites today, and County Clerk Gordy Holton said he thinks that 5,000 or more people could vote before Election Day. That would be well over 20% of the anticipated turnout of around 24,000 to 25,000 total votes. We're at 2,700 ballots cast right now, he said Monday afternoon, and we still have 1,000 Democratic vote-by-mail ballots out and 500 Republican ballots out. So I think it's reasonable to think that 3/4 of those will come back. That's another 1,200 votes. That gets us to 3,900, and I think we'll certainly be over 5,000 ballots cast prior to Election Day, maybe significantly beyond that. Once voters try voting by mail or early voting one time, he said, they very rarely go back to voting on Election Day. 4 years ago, in the last non-presidential primary election in Champaign County, 3,178 votes were cast before Election Day. Total voter turnout that year was 23,299. The large number of early voters so far, plus the fact that the University of Illinois and Champaign-Urbana schools are on spring break next week, could mean a quiet election day. Or if it ends up being anything like the election day we had in 2016, we'll be better prepared for it, having shifted thousands of voters to early voting and voting by mail, he said. That's one of the reasons we promote it so heavily. But the million-dollar question is, are we shifting turnout within the parameters of what we historically get? Or are we increasing turnout by having such incredible access to early voting and voting by mail? We'll find out next week. The primary election is March 20th. Holton contends that Champaign County provides greater access to early voting than any other election jurisdiction in Illinois. I base that on the fact that we run 9 early voting locations for 130,000 registered voters, and our locations are on perpetual. That means they're open for the entire period, he said. Once they're open, they're not closed. Some jurisdictions go to a nursing home for an hour or so, and they count that as an early voting location. The week of in-person early voting begins today on the University of Illinois campus with Illini Voting Day, as proclaimed by Illinois student government. Voting will be available for students and anyone else from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. in room 213 of the Illini Union. I expect the campus's busiest day will be tomorrow, Holton said, Monday. We are sending extra judges and extra stations to the union to make sure we move people through as quickly as we can. Any Champaign County voters can vote at any of the following early voting sites, and here's a list. Room 213, again, of the Illini Union, located at 1401 West Green Street in Urbana. Also, there's Church of the Living God, located at 312 East Bradley Avenue in Champaign. Another site is Leonard Recreation Center, which is located at 2307 Sangamon Drive in Champaign. The next location is Meadowbrook Community Church, which is located at 1902 South Duncan Road in Champaign. Another site or location, is Lake of the Woods Park Pavilion in Mahomet. The Gathering Place, 200 South Century Boulevard in Rantoul. Prince of Peace Lutheran Church, 802 South Douglas Street, St. Joseph. Also, the Tolono Public Library, which is at 111 East Main Street in Tolono. And that's the list, the complete list. Voting hours are the same at all sites, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., Tuesday through Friday, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday, and 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. Sunday, and then next week, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. again, Monday. Early voting hours at the County Clerk's Office in the Brooklyn Center, located at 1776 East Washington Street in Urbana, are longer, 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. Tuesday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday, and 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. again next Monday. The next headline reads, University of Illinois, Senate, commit to moving past chief. Faculty body offers series of campus actions. This article is written by Julie Wirth and is based out of Urbana. The campus senate is urging University of Illinois leaders to move beyond the decades-long Chief Illini WIC controversy by supporting Native American programs and research on campus and enforcing its trademark rights over chief imagery. By a 93-19 vote, the academic senate on Monday approved a resolution calling on the campus to use an upcoming critical conversation on Native American imagery in April as a springboard to further action, putting the chief in the institution's past. Submitted by the Senate's Equal Opportunity and Inclusion Committee, the resolution says Chancellor Robert Jones has taken welcome steps to move on from the chief, but the repeated appearances of the individuals dressed in chief regalia at athletic events further a climate that perpetuates racism and undermines the participation of American Indian students, faculty, and staff at those events. It calls on the campus to rebuild the American Indian Studies program on campus, which suffered after the U of I withdrew its job offer to one of its recruits, Stephen Salita, and make a robust commitment to use research there for educational programs about American Indian history and culture to help people understand the role of Native American mascots in misrepresenting that history. Those are the important ways and appropriate ways to have the university show its respect for American Indians, co-sponsor Catherine Oberdeck said on Monday. It also calls on the university to enforce its trademark rights over the chief and the phrase Oskiwawau, and better regulate uses of the racist mock Indian by university organizations. Oberdeck, chair of the Equal Opportunity Committee, said students have emphasized a need to move on from the chief debate to make the campus more welcoming, especially to Indigenous students. She said it's important for the university to support the American Indian Studies program, which is rebuilding after losing all of its core faculty, in the controversy over Salida's departure, and use research by Native American scholars in representations of its Indian heritage. She said the committee is dismayed by the small number of Indigenous students on campus, and the obstacle offensive imagery puts in the way of improving this record. There were no other public comments about the resolution at Monday's meeting, which had reconvened after the regularly scheduled March 5th session ran long. Slap in the face. Another resolution calling on the campus to stop appearances by unauthorized Chief Illini portrayers at U of I sporting events was pulled by its sponsor, Professor Jay Rosenstein. He said he wanted to make technical changes and needed to consult with other sponsors before bringing it back to the Senate. That resolution had said the appearances constitute a protest of the U of I's 2007 decision to retire the chief, violating policies that ban indoor protest at State Farm Center and Memorial Stadium. Last week, Breelyn, that's B-R-E-E-L-Y-N, Faye, a staunch chief supporter and member of the Honor of the Chief Society, spoke out against the resolutions. Faye, who said she is of Shawnee descent, applauded the goal of improving education and opportunities for Native American students in an all-inclusive community where no one is discriminated against or placed in hostile environment. Eliminating any vestige of our history will have the opposite effect, she argued. She accused faculty members of pushing their own warped opinions on a race they do not belong to. This is not an open dialogue. This is an insult, a slap in the face, not only to the thousands in the community who hold the nearly century-old legacy of the chief in their hearts, but to the multitude of natives on the other side of the issue whose existence you refuse to even acknowledge, including mine, she said. Chief opponents argue that the vast majority of Native leaders oppose the use of Native American imagery in sports. Oberdeck said she was surprised by the lack of debate Monday and encouraged by the strong majority in favor of the resolution. After the meeting, Provost Andreas Congelaris said the campus has made clear that conversations are very important and they have to be followed with action. And I think the campus is ready to take it and put the history behind us, think about the future, in a much more constructive way that brings the community together. He said the campus can't stop people from bringing costumes into the athletic venues, but what certainly are the rules that people are expected to abide by when they're in the arena is something the campus has complete control over. I hope the conversations lead us down a path that will help everybody come to terms with the fact that we are a campus where freedom of speech and freedom of expression are our foundation, but at the same time, expectations of behavior make all the difference in the world. Provost, I apologize. Also Monday, Congelaris said the two-week strike by the Graduate Employees Organization amounted to the most taxing and difficult time in his 21 years as a U of I faculty member, as I'm sure they have been for many of you. The provost was criticized for being out of town during part of the strike and for some of the language in mass mails to students and faculty about the contract dispute. Senators accused him of failing to consult with faculty leaders about contract provisions that affect academics and for suggesting that students who felt unsafe crossing picket lines contact U of I police. Over the past few weeks, we heard many voices on this campus, said Congelaris, who became provost in January. We heard voices of confusion, voices of anxiety, frustration, voices of suspicion, voices of disappointment, even rage. I said things, and I did things that were blamed as putting more oil in the fire that was amplifying those voices and criticized for being unhelpful. I regret this deeply, and I sincerely apologize for this, he said. He said graduate education and research are the foundation of the university, and we must double down on our commitment and support it and steward it in the years ahead, no matter what the headwinds, no matter what the challenges we encounter. Graduate students are our indispensable partners. We teach together, we research together, we learn together, he said. Their excellence is our excellence, and their success is our responsibility and our pride. And now we'll take a look at our weather forecast for the next week. This is provided to us by Greg Soule, that's S-O-U-L-J-E, and Greg, G-R-E-G, Greg Soule, and his column on the weather front. Today, the temperature will be 37 degrees, partly sunny, cold, a few flurries, northwest wind 12 to 24 miles per hour, gusty, Chance of snow will be at 30%. Overnight, couple of flurries early, clearly and cold, chance of snow will be at 20%. Wednesday, things warm up a little bit. The high will be 45, the low will be 21. Sunny, northwest to west wind 7 to 14 miles per hour. Overnight, mostly clear. Thursday, the high will be 50, the low will be 26, mostly sunny and milder. Friday, the high will be 45, the low will be 29. Increasing clouds, an isolated shower and spots late. Chance of rain will be at 30%. And Saturday, the high will be 52, the low will be 34 degrees, mostly cloudy. A shower and spots before noon and late. Chance of rain will be at 40%. And now let's take a look at Top of the Morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Jim Rosso. Game time for the third Gotthil, I think that's G-O-T-T-H-E-I-L, Gotthil Cup, has been set for 8 p.m. on March 30th at the U of I Ice Arena. The annual hockey fundraiser involving four U of I fraternities benefits the Josh Gotthil, or Gotthil Memorial Fund for Lymphoma Research. The host frat, Sigma Phi Epsilon, booked leather-lunged Blackhawks anthem singer Jim Cornelison, that's C-O-R-N-E-L-I-S-O-N, Cornelison, to perform the Star-Spangled Banner to rev up what hopefully will be a big crowd. Head to newsgazette.com for details on how you can help. Tickets are $5. Instrumental in making the event go is Diane Gotthil, Josh's mother, whose late husband, Fred, was a difference-making faculty advisor for Sig Epps. In Sunday's News Gazette and in a video at newsgazette.com, we'll hear more from Diane in Getting Personal. Josh's fund is a primary focus of time, Diane said, as are my two grandchildren. Online audience. What was trending last week at newsgazette.com, which in a seven-day period ending Sunday saw 1,264,414 page views. The three top stories were 1. Chicago man killed in Champagne shooting, 2. Muhammad man charged with molesting child, and 3. Charged, Tilton woman who allegedly drove Jeep into home of ex-boyfriend. The three top sports stories were 1. Illini forward has much to consider, 2. Smith to transfer from Illinois, and 3. What's next for Illinois basketball. The three top videos were 1. Crime Stopper, Champagne Target Theft, 2. Local Music Legends Take the Stage for Coaches versus Cancer, and 3. Collins Best of the Bunch, March 5th, 2018. The three top photo galleries were 1. High School 3A Sectional Semi, Central versus Lanphier, 2. 3A Sectional Semi, Muhammad Seymour versus Springfield Southeast, and 3. Dylan Wilson Therapy. In history, area history in 1918. Miss Esther M. Stolt, S-T-O-L-T, the first Champagne nurse to leave for the war in France, departed on Monday for Chicago, where she will join a base hospital unit that expects to sail abroad within a few days. In 1968, members of the Urbana Park Board ended a month of controversy Tuesday when they appointed both Walter Jackson and Richard L. Tice, T-H-I-E-S, to fill two vacancies on the board. This is something that's been needed for a long time, said Jackson, a Negro who works at Clifford Jacobs Forging. The park board needs someone on the board who can give them insight on the need of the Negroes. Again, that is from 1968. In 2003, in his first State of the State speech, Governor Rod Blagojevich lauded the University of Illinois for its technology breakthroughs and said he would create the state's first entrepreneurship center at the Urbana-Champaign campus to help turn those discoveries into successful businesses. The next headline reads, from Jim Dye's column, Dems aim to turn Quinn's strength into weakness. The prospect of longtime Democratic politician Pat Quinn winning his party's nomination for attorney general continues to give his party rivals heartburn, most especially Chicago State Senator Kwame Raoul. Raoul, the choice of party leader, was supposed to win the March 20th primary election in a walk. After all, he's been endorsed by those who matter and consequently has an ample campaign treasury. But one thing neither Raoul nor six other Democratic candidates have is what Quinn, a former governor, lieutenant governor, and state treasurer, has in spades, name recognition. Many voters have never heard of Raoul. State Representative Scott Drury, Highland Park Mayor Nancy Rottering, Chicago Park Board President Jesse Ruiz, and Chicago lawyers Aaron Goldstein, Sharon Fairley, and Renato Mariotti Meanwhile, Quinn, who got in the race late, is a household name in Illinois. And it's the result, of his nearly 50 years of campaigning for various causes, including himself, and publicly clashing with foes in both parties. Given the advantage that gives Quinn, the only alternative his Democratic opponents have is turning the 69-year-old politician's strength into weakness by tarring Quinn's reputation. In political terms, it's described as driving negatives up. Raul, obviously playing to the black vote in Chicago, recently recycled a political tactic former state comptroller Dan Hines unsuccessfully used against Quinn in the 2010 Democratic primary election. Hines, who is now out of politics, advertised recycled quotes from former Chicago Mayor, Harold Washington, who bashed Quinn as a useless high-level administrator whom he enthusiastically fired. "I must have been blind or staggering when I hired him. I would never appoint Pat Quinn to do anything. Pat Quinn is a totally and completely undisciplined individual," Washington said. It is difficult to say how much damage that kind of rhetoric will do to Quinn's campaign. After all, it's ancient history. Mayor Washington died in 1987. But there's another Quinn scandal out there that's not ancient history. It's recent history, the patronage hiring scandal at the Illinois Department of Transportation that was made public in 2014. Its reverberations continue to be felt as federal court monitor Noel Brennan, who was appointed by federal judge Sidney Shenkier, continues to examine a variety of state executive department for evidence of more patronage hiring like what occurred at IDOT under former governors Rod Blagojevich and Quinn. Raul is trying to make an issue of the illegal hiring scandal as well. Whether he'll be successful or not remains to be seen. But the allegations that Quinn presided over illegal hiring at IDOT go straight to the heart of whether he's the right man to be the Democratic candidate for Attorney General. After all, state attorneys general are supposed to enforce the law, not violate it wholesale. Although political patronage in the forms of jobs, contracts, and perks is endemic in the history of the state's wretched politics, it has been illegal since a 1990 U.S. Supreme Court decision, Rutan versus the Republican Party of Illinois. Since that landmark ruling, all state hiring, with the exception of high-level executive department jobs that are policymaking in nature, is required to be based purely on merit. Two reports, one conducted by State Inspector General Ricardo Meza, M-E-Z-A, and released in the fall of 2014, and another completed by Brennan in 2017, revealed the extent to which patronage hiring at IDOT became routine, first under Democratic Governor Rod Blagojevich, and then after Blagojevich's impeachment and removal from office under Governor Quinn. The illegal patronage hiring binge began after the 2006 election, when Democrats broke what had become a GOP stranglehold on the office that dated back to the 1976 election of former Governor James Thompson. Eager to reward campaign donors, party loyalists, family members, and friends, the Quinn administration started loading up IDOT with patronage employees. To evade hiring rules, they created phony staff assistant jobs that supposedly were Rutan exempt, but were in fact doing Rutan covered work. In a lengthy and detailed report, Brennan reported that 154 staff assistants were illegally hired between the years 2009 and 2014, regardless of their qualification or any needs IDOT had. Among those overseeing the illegal hiring, according to Brennan's report, were top Quinn officials, including chiefs and deputy chiefs of staff Jack Lavin, Ryan Croak, Mark Harris, and Sean O'Shea. They all were interviewed under oath by Brennan, each man denying any improprieties in light of all the evidence contained in her 89-page report. Brennan said their denials were not credible, quote-unquote. Both reports from Inspector General Meza and Court Monitor Brennan outlined an orgy of favor-seeking by politicians of all stripes, to the point that Judge Shenkier decided to expand Brennan's ongoing investigation to additional departments besides IDOT. Quinn professed to be shocked by the Inspector General's report and fired the head of IDOT. He later told the Chicago Tribune that he had no involvement in IDOT hiring issues, although it's clear that his closest subordinates were. Given the evidence implicating the Quinn administration, it's clear that Quinn either was aware of what was going on or made it a point not to be aware of the massive hiring abuse occurring right under his nose. Either way, he fails the test of propriety as it relates to the law enforcement position he is seeking. That's something his Democratic rivals are desperately trying to bring to the attention of primary voters. The next headline reads, Collision on County Road. Two hospitalized after crash. This article is written by Mary Shank and is based out of Sydney. Two men went to the hospital for non-life-threatening injuries after a crash Monday morning on a rural road in southern Champaign County. Champaign County Sheriff's Lieutenant Brian Menenga said one of the vehicles caught fire after the 9:20 a.m. collision about 4 miles south of Sydney. Menenga said William Balashki, that's B-I-A-L-E-S-C-H-K-I, 65, of Tolono, was driving east on County Road 500 North when he said he stopped at the stop sign for County Road 2100 East, looked both ways, then entered the intersection. His truck was hit by Charles LaRue, or LaRoe, that's L-A-R-O-E, 34, of Broadlands, who was heading north on 2100 East and did not have a stop sign, giving him the right-of-way. The collision pushed Bieleski's truck into the field on the northeast corner, and LaRoe's car went in a ditch just east of the intersection and caught fire. LaRoe was pulled from the car by a passing motorist and taken to Carle Foundation Hospital by ambulance. Menenga said Bieleski declined medical treatment at the scene but later went to the hospital. No tickets were immediately issued while the men were being treated, Menenga said. Both vehicles had to be towed from the crash site. The next headline reads, Sentencing. Armed robber gets 6 years for violent home invasion. This article is written by Mary Shank and is again based out, or no, this is based out of Urbana, excuse me. A Champaign County judge Monday sentenced a Chicago man with no prior criminal convictions to 6 years in prison for a violent robbery in a Northwest Champaign late summer where children were terrorized at gunpoint. We don't know what caused this, Judge Roger Weber said of the apparently uncharacteristic behavior of Tristan Marks, age 19. Weber agreed to recommend Marks for the Department of Corrections boot camp program, a military-like setting for about 120 days. Marks pleaded guilty a month ago to aggravated robbery for a July 10th intrusion at a home in the 1700 block of Paula Drive, where two masked, gloved men entered the home with a gun. One of the men put the gun to the head of one woman, while the other, believed to be Marks, put zip ties around her wrists and those of seven children, ranging in age from 8 to 16. Another adult male was similarly tied to a piece of exercise equipment in the garage, then pistol-whipped. The mother of the children testified Monday that the home was the residence of her ex-husband, and the children were there to visit him. She left to take the children's grandmother home, and when she returned, she found the tied-up victims and the intruders still in the house. They fled when she came in, and Marks was found hiding in the backyard by Champaign police. The other man has not yet been identified. The pair was looking for money, according to Assistant State's Attorney Scott Larson, but didn't find any. The woman testified that the incident left her children terrified. Assistant State's Attorney Tony Allegretti presented evidence that Marks has been a model prisoner in the county jail, has been in GED classes for two sessions, and has participated in several self-help programs. Because Marks never revealed who was with him, Larson said there was no reason to believe he would not return to committing crimes. Marks apologized for what he had done, and he was given credit on his sentence for 246 days served. I'm Susan Muirhead, and this has been part one of the News Gazette, dated for this date, Tuesday, March 13th, 2018. We'll continue reading part two shortly, so stay with us. Thank you very much for tuning in, and we hope you have a wonderful day.